Hello and welcome to The Front Page. I'm your host today, Tom Kerr, and on today's show we'll be talking betting revolutions, changing habits among Cheltenham racegoers and Grand National weights. But before we get on to the meat of today's show, we have to pay a tribute after the tragic death of Michael O'Sullivan, who suffered a fall at Thurles earlier in the month and passed away over the weekend, just days before his 25th birthday. Tributes poured in from across the racing world, led by his family, who described him as an extraordinary young man, full of kindness, integrity, ambition and love. In a week where we also lost Joe Saumarez-Smith at the age of 53, we at the Racing Post pass on our deepest sympathies to all those affected by the loss of these two men who had contributed so much to the racing world and who had so much more to contribute. For today's show, I'm delighted to be joined by Pete Scargill, welcome, and John Harding. Let's dive into it. Let's talk about our first subject, which is Andrew Black's column last week, in which he talked about a revolutionary idea to innovate around betting on racing, something which is, of course, something that the sport thinks and talks about a lot. Pete, why don't you tell us what Andrew Black, of course, the co-founder of Betfair, had for us?
Yes, we talk a lot about revolutionising things and then not doing it. So the fact that someone of Andrew Black's reputation and calibre, like you say, with his background at Betfair, sparks more interest than if it was coming from someone else. So Andrew Black's position fundamentally is that each way betting, I think he said, was a dinosaur fit for extinction, i.e. it offers the punter bad value, bookies like it, tends to work in their favour, and it's not gripping enough, it's not exciting enough, it's not dynamic enough in a market where other sports are offering different products, you know, your bet builders in football, for example, which has really captured that market. So his proposal was to do away with each way betting, essentially, and you would have a performance bet, i.e. you'd place your bet, and depending on how your horse performs, you'd get a payout. So it's not a strict each way bet. You're not doing a win and place element. You're doing a bet, and then depending on how it is, it grades down. And he put forward different ways that you could potentially work that. But he also, quite interestingly, and I think this is something that perhaps has been a little overlooked in some of the commentary in it since, is that he talked about if you did it properly, you could make it a thing of it during a race day, and you could capture the audience, and you could excite them through the day and keep them engaged with the racing as a product. So many people talk about, the race day needs to be more exciting, needs to be more there. We'll put on a concert, for example, which is great, but obviously a lot of people come for the music and the racing is a side act, whereas this would be something that would keep people engaged throughout the day. So yeah. I think it was quite a multi-layered proposal. And I think, we need innovation. We need different ways to attract people in because, horse racing has an older audience in terms of its betting audience, and it has a disproportionate number of larger bettors in terms of the people who place the bets on racing. So you need new ways of capturing people to get them engaged with the product. Otherwise, we're going to keep sliding down the scale in respect to other sports.
We haven't really had any sort of major evolutions of the betting product since Betfair. And I wrote in an email that went out to subscribers at the weekend about my recollections of the sort of noughties when all of my sort of peers my age were on Betfair. Yeah. Even people who weren't sort of gamblers were on Betfair because the novelty of it, the structure of the bets, the possibility of trading your way to success, having a green book, it really sort of grabbed people.
Beyond the idea of just a straightforward...
Exactly.
Bet, with a bookie at the race course. Yeah, I found it interesting that I didn't realise, because obviously I've been brought up in horse racing slightly different, that I didn't realise that it would have captured people in such a way. And it shows you that it can be done.
With everyone, honestly. Like people, the number of people I spoke to who sort of said, I've got a Betfair system, it really sort of captured the sort of zeitgeist, particularly if you were, among the sort of people who, might have an interest in sort of financial markets today, mm-hmm. or who might you know have an interest in other sort of sporting markets. It's very interesting. It's a bit like spread betting, of course. What
there's
proposing.
There's an element of that to it, yeah.
But I suppose the distinction being that with spread betting, your losses can mm-hmm. you know multiply quite quickly. This would be one that sort of.
But yeah, there's nothing wrong with riffing off spread betting to create a product.
Yeah.
Now it doesn't have to be completely new, does it? I mean, Betfair was only moving off something from financial markets into a betting market, wasn't it? It was a riff on that, really.
Yeah, so, of course.
I think it's something that should be looked into as a possibility, and maybe someone will be bold enough to offer it and see how it goes. Maybe even like a racecourse would do it. You know, could you see someone like Ascot doing it, for example? They're normally quite game for these kind of things.
Yeah.
Just
to
see how it works, because anyone that just says, you know, this is silly. What's the point? We just like backing horses to win a place. It's not going to push racing back in the direction it needs to go. Mm. It's not gonna move racing as a betting product back in people's favours into make it more interesting for people, is it? Otherwise,
no. And one of the things I think is quite clever about this is, you know, I think one of the difficulties with a lot of sports betting, but this applies to racing betting like others, is that it's very binary.
Mm.
You know, you win or you lose. Obviously, each way betting gives you more chances to win, but still, nonetheless, there's a very high probability you hand over your money, you watch the race, and then you go, oh Christ, it's gone. And I think that's potentially a challenge, particularly if, you know, people are sort of, you know, well exposed to things like stock trading, which is becoming much more sort of mainstream, particularly in the US, where mm-hmm. retail trading has exploded. You know, people are used to seeing these things as an investment, and they're quite happy to gamble mm-hmm. in the sense that they're taking risks, and they know there's a chance.
It feels more educational, if you have to put more brain power into it almost, yeah.
Absolutely, and there's a spread of outcomes as well, isn't there? John, you did a really interesting piece last year about the sort of decline of Betfair, I think it's fair to say.
Yes.
Yeah.
The exchange part of it anyway, yeah.
Well, the exchange part, yeah. Sorry, I'm still of the generation that when I say Betfair, I mean the exchange rather than the sports book. We should clarify there. You know, it really seemed, it was a period sort of 20 years ago, or three to about 15 years ago, where it seemed like that was going to be the future of betting, and it was going to completely, you know, sweep away all the old sort of models of betting and racing. Obviously, it did not happen.
Yeah, it was this massively revolutionary product, and I think now it's almost a cautionary tale of, even when you have a brilliant innovation like that that really does capture the imagination and have a huge following from big punters to, you know, regular punters and small staking, it just shows that you do have to keep freshening things up. One of the sort of the evidence that I was getting from people that were using the exchange regularly was perhaps it hadn't had enough love and enough development in that time from that core product, which was very good, by the way. And I think that's kind of where what Andrew Black is alluding to here is that other sports, for instance, football, and Pete quite rightly mentions bet builders, it used to be you back the outcome of the game or you have an accumulator and that's sort of it. Now you can bet on everything, pretty much players, sock height, you know, how many times the ref falls over. You can really bet on anything, and it lends itself to that, football in a way. Racing perhaps doesn't, but that doesn't mean that there's not things that can be done to sort of improve that offer.
People have tried to bring bet builders to racing, but I think it's a challenge because there's an immediacy to it in football, isn't there? You know, how many corners is someone going to get? Is someone going to be a first goal scorer?
Yeah.
You can stack together these different outcomes in a game in a way that racing is much harder. People have tried to do it with sort of sectional timings and top speeds and everything, but it's not as immediate, it's not as visual, so you can't necessarily see that your bet is winning. And it's just been difficult to sort of replicate that in racing, hasn't it?
It's harder because football is 90 minutes and you're sat there looking at your bet and you're watching a game over a course of an hour and a half, slightly
one
longer, and you're ticking
off,
things off, and that's part of that experience. Obviously, you doing that over a race that's a couple of minutes long is not quite the same experience. But I think that this performance bet is massively interesting to me because it's sort of when you think, actually step back and think about it from someone who has, let's say you have no knowledge of racing or betting or anything, and you back a horse to finish essentially each way, and it finishes fifth and second, and you don't get more for it finishing second.
I
can see why that, to somebody who's not familiar with it, would be a little bit confusing.
And part of the fun is identifying horses that the market undervalues. And of course, if you're a long-term player of racing, then you know that's the whole basis of generating income. But if you're doing it on a more of a irregular basis, on an occasional basis, you're not getting anything from identifying value bets because you need to place hundreds of them over the course of a year in order to generate the return you should get for outperforming the market. So this is sort of gives people who don't have that sort of length of commitment a chance to be rewarded for identifying horses the market is undervalued. It's quite interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And we also had news about growth in the black market, which I suppose is the sort of other strand of this, you know, the need for innovation and at the same time sort of the market leeching out to unlicensed illegal operators.
Yeah, I mean, and that's another aspect to consider. If you want to dismiss the performance bet as a novelty, something that doesn't need to be, you know, trying to fix something that's not broke. I think Andrew Black mentioned that in his column, isn't it? If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
Sort of an attitude. You only have to see these figures that were public. It was a report published by the International Federation of Horse Racing Authorities. Mm-hmm. I think I got that right.
Yes.
The FHA. And they'd done some research on the black market over a period of time from I think it was August 21 to September 24. And they'd monitored 22 black market sites, unlicensed, unregulated sites. And they'd found that in that period, there was a 522% increase in unique visitors during that period. 522%.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
crazy, isn't it? Even from a small base, which I think they said, that's huge. And there was a 131% in traffic as well. I mean, these sites are capturing people, enticing people. They are going there because they are struggling to place bets or to get bets on of the size they want in the regulated market.
Mm.
I mean, I got a call from a trainer last week who said, oh, I see you're writing about the black market again. And he said, you know, one of the things that annoys me is that I can't get a bet on my horse. And I called up Bucky the other day to place £50 each way on my horse, and I got knocked back for, you know, pennies in the end. And sort of what he said next was the concern to me. He said, you know what, I can't really be bothered anymore. I can't really be bothered, you know, what's the point? What's the point in putting myself through all of this?
Mm.
But, you know, and that's...
To bet.
And that's as much of a concern as people going away to the black market. It's people. It's an environment where people are being disincentivized and blocked, and they're just thinking, why bother? I don't need to have a bet. Why bother?
Yeah.
And that is troublesome.
There's so much friction in it now. You know, there's affordability checks, there's anti-money laundering checks, there's obviously restrictions that bookmakers place on accounts they don't want to take. There's documents you need to submit when you withdraw money. You know, some of this is by bookmaker choice. A lot of it is regulatory requirements. But you're absolutely right. You know, if you're in a situation where in sort of engaging with your hobby is so onerous, then.
And the flip side is that the black market operators are, by their very nature, completely frictionless.
Well, they don't care.
Because they don't have to.
Apart from possibly getting your money back.
I mean, there are problems with the black market, let's make that clear.
No, but I'm not advocating for the black market. I'm just saying that is, you know, that's, it's USP.
It'd be a very bold shout if you were advocating for the black market.
But that's this USP, isn't it? There is no friction.
Of course.
They're basically saying,
there's no safer gambling
stuff.
Do
what you want,
you
can do whatever you want. And I think it's just... What struck me about that story was the Gambling Commission coming out the next day and saying that they're going to be clamping down on this, having perhaps been a little bit, I think it's fair to say, not quite recognising the scale of the problem to begin with. But having, this is a bit of a segue, but going to the Asian Racing Conference and hearing somebody from the Hong Kong Jockey Club talk about the situation they have over there, the figures involved and the sophistication of these black market operators is scary.
Yeah. And it's a huge opportunity for them, and they're moving in. They're, you know, we don't operate in a vacuum. If you make the regulated market incredibly difficult to access, then people are going to turn to alternative options. We're going to move on now, but just a reference. We ran our big punting survey closed last week. We're going to be publishing the results next week. I've obviously been reviewing them. We've got 10,000 responses, some extraordinary numbers in there about the growth of the black market. We'll be sharing all of that the week after this, and I think it's going to be pretty eye-opening indeed. So a little sneak preview of what you will hear when that comes out. But we're going to move on to our second story, which is, let's start with Pictori and Paul Nichols landing, unbelievably, his first Grade 1 since Pictori won the Ascot Chase a year ago. It was extraordinary, John.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear that, actually. I wasn't aware of that going into the race, but that just shows, I mean, it explains a lot of the frustration that that's been coming out from Paul Nichols in interviews in recent weeks, and I think he should be credited actually, because by his own admission, he's quite upfront about the fact he doesn't have the caliber of horses that he used to have. He's not really getting the right horses into the stable at the moment to compete with Nicky Henderson and Dan Skelton at the, well, Nicky Henderson for quality and Dan Skelton at the top of the Trainers' Championship. It's all relative, of course. He's still second in the championship. He's going to be okay. I think, as Lee wrote it, it's not time for a whip round or anything like that. But I sense that that win on Saturday was much needed, and you could tell afterwards that, you know, he still has his fire in the belly as well to go again and kick on and rebuild, because it's not been quite right at the top table for him.
No, no winners, no Grade 1 winners at Cheltenham last year, no Grade 1 winners at Aintree, no Grade 1 winners Christmas. I mean, it's incredible for Nichols, who's been at the top of British racing for so long. I think we've just become totally accustomed to him having success, even when we think he's in a sort of a transition period. We still expect him to be lobbing in these winners. You could see what it meant to him. He's fiercely competitive. He has been doing well in the trainer's title. But look at, you know, with the greatest respect in the world, if you look at his Cheltenham squad, it really does paint quite a stark picture. I think you did the chat with him. You know, he's obviously got some decent shots to throw at the festival. He is more sort of judicious in where he targets the horses, and he does look at other spring festivals now. But at the, when we published it last week, there wasn't, I think 14 to 1 was the shortest price about any of his runners at Cheltenham, and barely any contenders in the championship races.
Yeah, and that's the worrying thing, is not having a sort of champion chase, Gold Cup type horse, but he just doesn't at the moment. A lot of his, what you would call his bigger horses that have come in for quite big price tags, they are younger, they are projects, and I think it's just a reflection of where he's at the moment. He's in that dip, and unlike a football club going out and just signing a star striker in January and it turning around instantly, horses take that time to develop, and it is cyclical. He's been here before, of course. You know, he's had that lean spell at Cheltenham. He's had lean spells, full stop, and then he's come back and smashed in a few trainers' championships. So, you know, I'm sure he's on top of it. And like you say, fiercely competitive.
You're not going to bet against Nichols. But, the other sort of story last week concerning Nichols was about his sort of scouting team and the greater involvement of Megan Nichols and the slightly less prolific involvement of Tom Malone. What do we make of that, Pete?
Well, it's clearly a reflection upon what's going on. You don't make changes necessarily when things are going well. So he's looking at what he's got in his yard, and he's saying, can I do anything more? Is there something I can change? And he's looked at the system of bringing the horses in and gone, yeah, perhaps there's something I can change here. I'll look in a different direction. Different people have different contacts. You know, Tom Malone's bought Gold Cup winners in the past. He bought Native River. So, you know, he's a guy with a track record. But, you know, everyone goes through, a bit like we're talking about, everyone goes through periods where they're able to secure horses in different ways. I mean, I think Tom Malone bought Wind Beneath My Wings, which is one of the favourites of the bumper for David Pipe. So, you know, it makes sense to look in different places to try and get going. And there was a point that Lee, again, made in his piece that he did from Ascot on Saturday, where Paul Nichols sort of listed the owners that he's been fortunate enough to train for, and he mentioned Paul Barber, and he mentioned John Hales, for example, two people who are no longer with us. And, you know, he needs to be able to keep attracting the owners within his yard and other owners to come and spend big. And they need to have the confidence that if they are spending big, they've got a good chance of getting something out of it. Because in the end, we know that you tend to do well if you spend more money on horses.
So,
tend to.
I mean, that's the problem, though. You know, like, is it... He has owners who spend big money,
but if they're losing their confidence because of the system, then they need to make a change, don't they? Or they look somewhere else.
So. But you obviously do a bit of buying and selling horses. Give us a feel for just how key it is to have your sort of buying network, your scouting network on point in order to sort of compete at the top level for these big trainers.
Well, I mean, I think particularly with National Hunt Racing, which is an area I'm not as involved in, shall we say, the period from when a horse is born to when it reaches the racecourse is obviously longer than it is on the flat. So you're getting information all of the time. You're getting horses through different sets of hands. They're going through different places. A lot of it happens off the track or in different countries with France. So you need to be able to have people on the ground, and you need to be able to be the first person to get wind of a horse. And then you need to be able to know that if you do, you can send that up the line and someone can buy it. Because it's all well and good finding a horse, but if you've got no one to buy it, then it's equally, you know, you need to have the clients. So for someone like Paul Nichols, you know, he was so successful back in the early 2000s with buying those horses from France. Him and Anthony Bromley had this great system where they were able to pluck all of these horses. Other people have moved into that situation because they saw how successful it was. So you can't, you know, he's got to innovate. I mean, he talks a lot about Sir Alex Ferguson, doesn't he? He's the owner in his yard, Paul Nichols. And I think how many different times Ferguson rebuilt, was it three big rebuilds at Manchester United during that time? When he noticed things weren't going right, he made decisive changes. So I think it's within the context of things just not quite singing, and he's just trying to look for a different angle on things. And, you know, Megan Nichols will have a different set of contacts. She'll know different people. She'll have access to different yards and different setups. So it makes sense to bring somebody new in to try and just get it singing a little bit more, because it's just offbeat at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, 600k behind in the trainer's title. He got five in the Grand National though, John. So it's
I mean, if he wins that, if he gets a 1, 2, 3, 4 in that, then suddenly it's a different conversation, isn't it? And he's got good chances as well.
Yeah, he'll throw a few darts at the Scottish National, as he often does as well.
Yeah, and he'll have a good squad for Aintree. You know, that is part of it. He's quite, if he doesn't think he can compete with a horse at Cheltenham, he will save them for somewhere else.
Nothing's going to fire up Paul Nichols more than a bunch of journalists talking about what a tough time he's having.
Yeah, and this sounds like a stupid thing to say, but Nichols loves winning. Yeah. In terms of trainers, I haven't come across a trainer who just loves winning any race, loves it. So that chance to prove people wrong and to win more, that's right up his street.
Let's turn to Cheltenham. It was a really interesting story that we covered last week about some of the changing habits of racegoers at the festival, which was sort of based on some Irish sort of travel operators giving some feedback, where they were saying that what they're seeing is that there's fewer and fewer people going for all 4 days. Lots of people go for the Tuesday and Wednesday. Some people go for a day trip on the Friday or overnight on the Friday. It feels very much in line with what, you know, we've all seen happening at Cheltenham over the last few years. The first couple of days always fantastic. The Gold Cup day, brilliant. Thursday, struggling. The atmosphere in town, not anything like what it used to be. Obviously, accommodation costs are so high. But it's really changing the character of the festival, John, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But none of this is particularly surprising, I don't think. We've covered it at length about the cost of accommodation. I mean, you're talking hundreds and hundreds of pounds. Attending the festival is an expensive thing to do. Yeah. And you can say all you like that it's in keeping with other sporting events, etc., etc. But the reality is, if it doesn't make financial sense for people to go for multiple days, then they're going to cut back or just stop entirely. And I think that's just what's happening.
I was thinking about this because we work in racing and we work within the confines of our experiences within racing, right? How many other sporting or leisure pursuits would you go for all 4 days? I was thinking like a test match was the only thing I could think of off the top of my head. You know, would people go
people go to World Cups and... I mean, if they're Scottish fans, they don't spend that long there. But
that's once every 4 years, though, isn't it? Yeah. I'm just trying to think whether it's a Cheltenham thing, i.e. people aren't going to Cheltenham because Cheltenham's too expensive, racing's rubbish at Cheltenham, experience is rubbish at Cheltenham, my car gets stuck in a car park at Cheltenham, or whether it's a general thing that people don't go
to these things as a border,
and therefore, is it, you know, racing is only following that, and therefore, you know, Cheltenham and whoever need to adapt to the fact that there's a changing dynamic of people.
It's quite a full-on week if you do it properly.
We're all
getting older, and you know, it's one of the points that the travel agents actually made is that, you know, people, the sort of profile of people going now, maybe not as able to handle 4 consecutive hangovers. I certainly can. it's a long week, isn't it? You know, it's a long week if you're going hard.
So therefore it falls into, if people aren't coming for that, if you can't rely on people to come for the whole week because the magic of Cheltenham It's like the magic of Cheltenham isn't enough to entice them. You've got to make sure that when they do come, they think that is a banging day. They think that's a proper day of racing. Yeah. I've enjoyed that. So that really needs to be central to what is offered by Cheltenham and the racing that's on. People have got to come and think that was really worth doing it. Maybe next day I'll go for 2 days instead of. I think you know that customer experience has really got to be
the
very
tricky
important.
Thing there, right? Is that I think you're at the Tuesday and Wednesday are absolutely fine. The Friday is absolutely fine. What do you do about a problem like Cheltenham Thursday?
Move it to Saturday, John. Have a day off in the middle.
Make the festival five.
Make it 3 days. There you go.
Yeah.
So I'm sold.
Well, there will be people listening who think that is probably the answer. But yeah. I don't understand. I just don't.
Just leave it there.
I just don't. I don't see.
We'll clip that one up for social media.
I don't see why the Thursday is that much. Is not appealing in the way that the other days are. Okay, you've not got a Gold Cup, you've not got a Champion Chase or Champion Hurdle, but the Paddy, the Stairs Hurdle, and the and the Ryanair, they're still good races in their own right. I don't think for the general race goer that they're going, oh no, I'm not going to touch the Thursday because of the races. I just can't see why that would be. Maybe it's a consequence of just logically people staying over, and then the Friday's probably its own isolated thing. I don't know about the consumer behaviour, but as far as the racing's concerned, I've never really understood it. If you're a real devotee, it is slightly weaker day, but not by a huge amount. If you're the general public who wants to go to Cheltenham, does it really matter?
It's a tricky one. So Guy Lavender, the new boss at Cheltenham, he's got a bit of a challenge on his hands. Some of the mood music suggests that maybe we're going to see declining sales again this year, you know, a few consecutive years. Cheltenham, such a income driver for the Jockey Club, which owns Cheltenham, and thus for all of racing, as well as obviously being the sort of the World Cup, the Olympics of jumps racing. He's got a challenge there, doesn't he?
Massively. Yeah, because everything that the Jockey Club does for the months that follow rests on how much money that they're able to bring in at Cheltenham, ultimately. I mean, that's quite a simplistic way of looking at it, but it is massive for the Jockey Club financially. And it is a challenge because, I'm sure afterwards you'll hear it in various quotes and things, that it's a competitive environment and this is in keeping with other leisure trends, but just focusing on itself, there is work to do, I think, to get the Cheltenham Festival back in people's minds as something that they have to go to, not something that they might like to.
My barometer for how affordable the Cheltenham Festival is, or going to the Cheltenham Festival, is the Holiday Inn Express in central Cheltenham, which I can report, as of this morning, was £600 a night from the Monday to the Friday, which is actually down from the heights it's previously been. It's, you know, sort of £900 a night, but still £600 a night.
A night.
Yeah. I mean, staying in a three-star hotel in the centre of Cheltenham is.
I just about count as under 30, and I'd like to speak on behalf of all under 30s when I say £600 a night is ridiculous. You can go abroad for a week.
Yeah, as many people do, and you know the Costa del Cheltenham trend, Benidorm, people going out there, and yeah.
I just don't know who has that sort of money. A night, do you know, to go to a pretty average hotel in Cheltenham?
Yeah.
No offence to that particular hotel.
Other hotels are available at even more expensive rates. Let's move on to the Grand National, because it was the weights up in Liverpool, and John, you were there.
I was.
Tell us your impressions. What did you think of the Grand National weights? Well, let's talk about the news that came out of it, because it's probably the most important thing, isn't it, rather than
you'll find out about
what you made. What did you have for lunch? Gravy train in full force. The main thing was, sort of came out of it, was we had a new favourite for the race, which was I Know the Way You're Thinking, Gavin Cromwell's horse, one of eight GP horses in the first 34.
Yeah, he's having a good old crack at it.
He certainly is.
McManus. Yeah, I Know the Way You're Thinking was the one that really came out of it, because he's ninth in the list. I just consult my notes here, 11 stone 5. He's going the right way. I think that Martin Greenwood, the handicapper, was saying this is a race now that suits a younger horse, and in terms of the profile, he's pretty much perfect, you think. He's run two, to my mind, career best performances the last twice, going the right way, at least on race and post ratings, and you'd imagine he's going to be bang there. He's quite a short price, given some of the competition.
What was the vibe in it? Because initially he wasn't even going to be entered in the race. apparently. And then there was sort of talk from Cromwell, I think even he had a press day, didn't he? And he kind of said, well, I don't know whether he's going to go. And now he's favourite. So have they said he's going for the race? Or has everyone just gone, God, he has to go for the race, we're going to make him favourite?
I believe he's going for the race, yeah.
Okay.
I believe so. That was the impression I got. Nobody said, oh, by the way, he's not. He might not go still. But there is a lot of, that's the problem with the Grand National weights, probably moving on a bit quickly, but there are so many horses in there where you almost get the list of the weights and then you're looking down and trying to think, well, they're not going to run, they're not going to run, they're not going to run, and then which ones come in. Mm. And it's usually those ones around the cutoff that are particularly interesting. Three Card Brag was one that was mentioned by a few people who might sneak in and be quite interesting. There's a few like that. It's a confusing process, actually, the Grand National weights.
What did you think of it? Tell us now. People patiently waited for your reflections.
I had a fantastic day, thank you.
Good.
I met Neptune Collange.
Outside.
Amazing. That was nice. That is nice. Food was great. No, my impression is firstly, it's a good event. I like the idea that it's in Liverpool. There's a huge community thing, and there's some local, very talented local people come and do some things. That's good. You have the Older Hay connection, which is lovely and really important.
The Children's Hospital, yeah.
Yeah, so that's there's a lot of that, and it's a good event. I like the idea of generating a bit of excitement. There just is still then that element of you get the weights and you almost need to sit and dissect them a bit and try and work out where the value might be. And a lot of it is working out which horses are going to run there. I think my overall impression from looking at that list of horses is the quality has gone up massively.
Yeah.
And it's becoming a little bit of just a throwaway line now that it's a different race. But it is. And
better horses, younger horses.
You know, you've got Lom Presse, you've got multiple grade one winners. I think in the top 17 of the top 23 in the list have won a grade one, which says everything really about the race.
It's extraordinary. And a sort of mix of profiles between the ones who are being laid out for it, who don't appear in a chase from one year to the next, and those who are actually competing at, you know, often top level.
Yeah, and there's guys, several ways to skin a cat, isn't there? And there's a lot of people taking different routes. I still quite like the cross-country route, the old Tiger Roll nostalgia there. Yeah. I like that. Stumptown's quite interesting, although he's been rather... he's been quite unfairly treated, I think, possibly. He would have been my selection before the weights came out.
Right. But not now.
Not now. Can-do kid.
Can-do kid. Excellent. We don't normally do tips, for good reason. But
it's not a tip. Not a tip. Just he interests me.
Okay, excellent. David Jennings wrote an interesting column,
didn't he,
about the road to Aintree, and he was sort of suggesting that we want to make it more interesting, we want to make it more about qualifying. So his idea was sort of have 20 qualifiers run from the jump season, beginning of the jump season up to Aintree, with you have to finish in the first three to qualify. He said you could also qualify via grade one chases. It's a nice idea, you know, because I guess it then does address these sort of horses who are sort of tucked away in finishing 12th in hurdle races.
That's true. It's David Jennings, who always used to criticise the Potemps final at the Cheltenham Festival.
Yeah.
He's all for qualifiers now. I can see why.
It does feel a bit Potemps-y.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, I mean, Lee has been a long-time proponent of winning your in certain races. I think there is a good thing to be said for generating more interest throughout the season about the Grand National. The Grand National is the biggest race of the year. Mm. Biggest race, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you're generating interest throughout the year, if you're getting people thinking about it and talking about it all the way through the year, is that not of greater benefit than you've got the entries and then you've got the weights, and as John said, a lot of the bit after the weights is everyone trying to figure out who's actually going to run, what's in, what's not. You've actually got a better idea before Aintree arrives who might be participating. Now, I can see that. I mean, David Carr did a fascinating front runner email that goes out to Racing Plus subscribers. We just sampled a random group of people who happened to be walking past I think it was Lime Street Station he was at. And most people kind of said, I don't really follow the Grand National, or Red Run won it, you know, all this sort of stuff. A couple of people said, yeah, it's interesting, I like going, it's a good day. But now, would having more stories about the Grand National, would have people having a better idea, if they happen to be turning on ITV Racing and they know that this horse might end up in the Grand National, is that a better way of generating interest and sort of momentum behind stuff. I don't know, rather than tucking a horse away. So, you know, if Intense Raffles wins the Grand National this year, like you say, he's been unsighted in two hurdle races so far. He's obviously got to have another run to qualify. But then, you know, it's almost that it's all about that day, and it's sort of in its own bubble, just that event, and then it goes away.
There isn't really any build-up other than past winners coming again. Mm. Yeah.
Do winning your in races really cut through, though?
Well, I'm not saying everyone's going to be tuning in to watch the Badger Beer Chase going call. We're going to see the Grand National. Yeah. Isn't it? But I'm saying if you get a better idea of what the field is, maybe the Racing Post does a running Grand National. I don't know. I'm not the editor. That's why you make the decisions, and I don't.
Ideas welcome.
You know, I'm just saying you make the Grand National a more than a one day event. You make it it's all part of, I mean, a bit like Cheltenham. People are going on about the whole build up. Everything's about Cheltenham, but then everyone loves Cheltenham Festival. So you can have it both ways. I'm just wondering whether what DJ's saying is where you make it more of a thing, it then becomes greater than it has been and where it should be.
Well, I think in a very neat segue to the top of the show, we've got to try new things.
Precisely.
What finer place to leave it. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your time. And thank you so much to you at home for tuning in. Please do come and see us again next week when we'll be chewing over the biggest stories from the racing world. And in the meantime, there's a whole host of other fantastic video content coming out on the Racing Post over the coming days, including our latest Cheltenham In The Know, which will be online very shortly indeed. Until then, thank you very much.